time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way.
Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall. Loving you later, if at all. No right minds could wrong be this many times.
What do you do to mark the 1 year anniversary of a hurricane called Irene, which has caused record flooding and devastation, destroyed businesses, homes, livelihoods, and changed lives forever? Why, you have a mud fest, of course.
Very early on, when I attended meetings in the community, few people with famous senses of humor started kicking around the idea of a mud fest. And I think it was, you know, a kind of gallows humor. It was very early on after the flood, and they were dreaming of the things that they would have at this mud fest. So one of the things they wanted was a demolition derby, because they felt that that was what the flood had felt like to them, someone said to me. They wanted mud wrestling. They wanted mud slides, both literally and the vodka drink. They wanted mud facials and mud fountains made out of chocolate, and it just went on and on and on. Mud pies. This list kept growing and growing and growing, and it was great because we all laughed.
That was Caroline Bennett, historian of the town of Prattsville and the curator / director of the Zadok Pratt Museum, named for the founder of Prattsville, a small community in the northwest corner of Greene County, and that was one of the hardest hit by Hurricane Irene.
And then a group of, they're young, I say young relative to me, they have young growing families in Prattsville, so they really are the future of Prattsville. So what happened is they decided it was a good idea to have Mudfest. And while it's not going to be a demolition derby, there will be mud games. There is going to be a play about the effects of the flood. There are going to be vendors. So it will be a kind of mini celebration, I think, of their resilience and their having come out of something that was a real negative with a positive spirit. And I think that's what Mudfest is. It's saying to themselves and the world, okay, this happened, but we're going to take mud and we're going to make mud pies. At one point, we were kicking around a tagline for the town, and someone said, the little town with the big sense of humor. But that was the one that I liked the best, because I think it's really true. You know, it's a very small, tight, still in many ways 19th century community in many of its values. And they're lucky that one of those values is a sense of humor.
Almost 1 year ago, on August the 28th, Hurricane Irene hit mainland USA with what turned out to be a 1-2 punch. First came the torrential rains and raging winds. Next, rivers and streams burst their banks, flooding the surrounding areas and destroying much of what lay in their paths. WGXC is dedicating its coverage over the weekend of August 28th to September the 3rd, 2012, to After the Flood, a look back at the record-breaking weather calamity that rocked our region. And the first half of this show is a forerunner of that coverage. The second half of the show, we're turning over to Andrew Amelinx, who is a crime reporter, an artist, a self-described man about town. And we're going to air an excerpt from his Difficult History series that he did for WGXC last year that explores different ideas through the context of local lives. And this episode will be about fear and danger. But first, back to tales of after the flood.
The geology of a place like Prattsville is quite resilient in that very little real modification of the landscape has occurred. The damages to the people, the damages to their houses, and the geology ended up very much as it had been previous.
That was the Catskill geologist, Robert Titus, professor of geology at Hartwick College, who, along with his wife Johanna, who is professor of biology at Duchess College in Poughkeepsie, has been keeping track and writing about the impact of Hurricane Irene.
My wife and I started exploring just 2 days after the hurricane was gone. Well, we try to be a scientist, we try to be a geologist in our explorations, and we've seen the same pattern over and over and over again. Prattsville was built on an ice age feature that I call an alluvial fan. It's a heap of sediment that was transported into the Schoharie Creek Valley by a stream at the close of the ice age. And that's exactly what happened in Margaretville. It's what happened in Middleburg. It's happened in Schoharie. All of these towns are constructed upon the same kind of ice age feature called an alluvial fan. And all of these fans rise up above the level of the river, Schoharie Creek. All of them gave a false sense of security by raising above the level of the river. People felt, aha, we're safe. The flood won't reach us. But I like to liken it to what happens when you squeeze a garden hose. When you squeeze the nozzle of a hose, you increase the speed of the water and you increase the power of the water. You'll do that any time that you wash your car. The alluvial fan acts like a thumb on a garden hose. It increased the speed of water passing through the town, and it increased the power of the water. I call this the garden hose hypothesis for what happened to these villages. I don't know that this has been recognized in the past. I've been publishing my ideas in Catskill Life magazine and trying to develop a formal scientific theory to explain what happened.
And when was the last time anything as major as this happened on this kind of level with this amount of rain?
Well, there was an awful hurricane in 1869, but you can well imagine the collective memory of that is not very strong anymore. This sort of thing does happen and will happen. It's separated by decades, even sometimes by centuries. But these horrible events can be expected to return. And we hope they won't, but they certainly will if we're just long enough.
Do you think that this sort of thing could happen again?
Yes. I would say with great certainty that the next time we have an enormous hurricane such as Irene was, where 16 inches of rain came down in the eastern Catskills, that it would be an exact duplicate of what happened. The water would back up when it reaches Prattsville and then try to squeeze through the Prattsville area and not be able to, and the result would be a flood.
And have there been any efforts to prevent this from happening again?
Yes, indeed. They have put up they've done some channelization. They have put up a wall of very sizable boulders mounted on a berm of sediment. It's very doubtful that this will have any real positive influence, and the next time this happens, I suspect the flood will just simply go right into town in much the same way as it did this time.
And here's Caroline Bennett again.
Many of the businesses on Main Street are back. You can see that. That's very visible. And a few of the homeowners are back. I think a lot of the homeowners, though, haven't decided, on Main Street this is, whether they're coming back or not. So I'm not sure of how many. I'm going to take a guesstimate and say, please, anyone listening, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but maybe 120 130 families on Main Street, and I'm going to guess that of those families, I think this is a generous guesstimate, there might be 30 that have that are living back in their homes. Many of them, again, young people. I say young, maybe they're in their 30s or their 40s, who are business owners, just went ahead and opened, and some of them are building larger. They're reinvesting in the town so that Jim Eisel of Great American is now building in his parking lot closer to the Prattsville Diner a bank of, can't think of another word, but a row of stores, four of them, with room for more growth, and he already has renters for three. And anyone that has seen what the Youngs are doing over there at Agway, they're building, they're rebuilding not only bigger, but better. It's incredible what they're doing over there. So that's a real investment of time, money, and faith in the town. Of course, the O'Haras did that very early on also. So, yeah, I definitely think that this is one way to say to the world, come and see, we're back on our feet, and we're viable, and we're going to grow. Although, you know, some of the ways in which they'll grow are still up in the air, because you'll see a lot of vacant houses, because it's not certain at this point whether they will be knocked down or whether the people will rebuild. So, but I think in the next year or two, you will see some people make decisions that they just weren't able to make in the first year following the flood.
We know what the short-term impact of Hurricane Irene was, but what would you say the long-term impact would be?
Well, there's only one possible long-term impact, and it's on people. And gradually, we learned that you can't build villages in places that sooner or later are going to experience disasters of this sort. Prattsville looked like a good bet. It's elevated 20 to 30 feet above the level of the river. It must have looked very safe 150 years ago when people were building the town. But the problem is that too much water was squeezed into that stretch of the valley. And it rose those 20, 25 feet above the level of Schoharie Creek, and it thus rushed into town and through town. Any new building in Prattsville should be pulled away from the river and pulled in an uphill direction. And people who live in Prattsville should be aware that what they saw, they can see again. And the same, of course, applies to Windham, Schoharie, Middleburg. We really can't just pick upon poor Prattsville.
Here's Carolyn Bennett again, talking about the recovery efforts at the Zadik Pratt Museum.
Well, thanks to the generosity of a lot of people, and I'm not going to name them here. They know who they are, so many that I couldn't name. We are viable in a way that many thought we wouldn't be after the storm. But with that said, I mean, we opened our doors with an exhibit by Larry Gambin, and we did so in the museum not only to show the effects of the flood and part of the recovery, but also to show how the museum was affected. And we own three historic buildings on Main Street. We're committed to restoring all three of them to their correct period look, the museum being the primary one. But we face a number of, we're taking, I think, all of our challenges short, long term, meaning, if you hyphenate that word, that in short term, we need $25,000 in order to dry out the documents that we did find funding for to freeze as part of the freeze-dry stabilization process. Once those documents have been, that's the entire paper collection of the museum. Once they've been dried, they can be shipped back home, and then little by little, in the long term, we'll work on having them conserved, because having them dried isn't the same as having them returned to the condition that they were before the flood. It just means that they're stabilized and so they won't deteriorate. We have a lot of Pratt furniture that was in frozen storage, cold storage. It's coming back to the museum on the 28th of August from where it's been stored. We had to store it there because we had to strip the first floor of about three quarters of its walls, so you see studs when you come in. But it'll be returned, and I'm working with a furniture conservator who says that it can at this point dry naturally, and again, we will photograph it, and we will then try to find individual donors, foundations that might want to adopt a piece of furniture that they'd like to see us restore. Of course, the buildings themselves, we were very lucky to be given money to do historic structures reports for two of our three buildings, the museum and the commercial building, and that process will start next month. It's a team headed by restoration architect Marilyn Kaplan, and I really have to say thank you to the O'Connor Foundation, which has been incredible to us. They funded the historic structures reports, and that's the first step in any process towards leveraging the money to actually do the restoration, the bricks and mortar work. So we're moving along slowly, and when I say short hyphen long, what I mean is that we're sort of looking at it as a circle instead of a line. So in the center of the circle is, we're looking at anything that belonged to Zadig Pratt or his family, and then we're restoring that. We move out of the circle to anything that relates to Prattsville, first in the period of his life, and then, you know, we had a collection that included things, the whole 20th century. We had scrapbooks of Prattsville in the 20th century. So we'll restore that in the second circle. The third circle is Greene County. And we'll look at our collections, and if we can return anything to other towns and organizations, we will do that by deacquisition. And that's about it. So that's our plan, and we need help.
And if you've just joined us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're looking at the community of Prattsville 1 year after Hurricane Irene. Here's Larry Gambon, local wildlife and nature photographer, talking about his exhibition that's currently up at the Zadig Pratt Museum.
I guess probably three components to the show. I have just some photos tacked to the wall at the entrance, just of the destruction and the cleanup at the museum. And then on the two rooms on either side of the entrance, I have photos of the destruction right after the storm, and then of the cleanup, of people coming together and really helping each other and just fixing things, it mainly is. I mean, there were so many things going on. I took photos for mainly about 6 weeks running. And it went from just massive destruction to people fixing. You know, you see the furniture outside, everything drying out, everything being gutted, right down to just seeing like the skeletons of the buildings after a while, where they were just taking everything out and fixing it.
And what's been the reaction of people who have seen the exhibit?
It's a very strange thing. I mean, some people will stand there in the foyer, start crying, and not come in. I've seen a lot of people crying, just going through the exhibit. Other people are stunned, especially people who don't live there. when, if you don't live there, they'll walk around, and they're pretty solemn when they get out. But it's the tears, the people who live there, it's the tears. I mean, I do wildlife and nature photography, and my photography is always about, wow, I love this, this is great. This is one of the most difficult things I've ever done. I was really, really surprised that people would just start crying at their photos.
And you've been pretty close to this whole thing since the hurricane happened. What would you say is the current kind of temperature of the people?
I think they're some of the most determined people I've ever met in my life, to be honest with you. I mean, in certain sections of the town, it's like a building frenzy. They can't get it done fast enough because they really do want to put it behind them. You can see the Agway there, Jim's Agway there. It's coming back so much bigger and better, and they were devastated over it in that area. And I'm just so proud of them because they're really, really putting in such an effort to be bigger and better and to show the town that, you know, it's not down and out. There's big sections of the town that haven't even been touched because of FEMA money, insurance money, and all sorts of problems and paperwork, and it's just amazing. I've heard so many stories about what should not have been done because FEMA has thrown down so many different rules and created new rules on the fly. And despite everything, these people are coming back. They have a spirit that is just amazing.
What do you think are the biggest challenges going forward?
Money, number one, first and foremost. There's a lot of fear that it's going to happen again because the government stops us. This is in the New York City watershed, and all of these creeks and streams used to be dug out and managed, which they're not done anymore. And I know that a lot of people were screaming for the previous 4 years that they needed to get these creeks cleaned out, and nothing was done. And after this flood, there was a lot of anger, because they know it floods up here. And it was just so many rules, you weren't allowed to go into the streams to do anything. And thus the flood.
Do you think that people are optimistic, though, about the future? Do you think that they see things getting better? Do you think they believe things are getting better?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are some people that are not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very sure that people are very optimistic. I'm there downtown a couple of times a week, and it's just like the same old Prattsville as far as the people are concerned. There's stretches of town that don't look so hot, but, you know, it's just the spirit of the people that's gonna make this come back. And it's just time. It's just time. I'm sort of amazed that it's taking this long, because if you go to Wyndham, everything looks great. Everything looks fine. If you go to Prattsville, it hardly looks good at all. It hardly looks like anything's been touched since the flood.
Mm-hmm. What did you discover through all of this process?
That I'll never live near water.
Mm-hmm.
I will never live near a stream. I'm totally stunned by what the power of water can do.
How has it affected you as a photographer? How do you use something like this, other than the exhibition, as a photographer?
I don't know. I'm not even sure I even processed this whole thing yet. It's so different from any photography I've ever done in my life. It's been the most time-consuming project I've ever been involved in. I've put in well over 800 hours on this,
mm-hmm.
and my wife also.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you just keep going. And the exhibition is in the museum, or what would you, it's there to raise money for the museum, because the museum is been devastated, and there's no funds coming in, and so I'm raising money, and I've sort of become obsessed with doing that, because you know, you just can't say, well, I'll let other people do it. And I'm friends with all the people in the museum, and you know, I can do something, And so I do it. And it's costing a lot of time, but there you have it. Someone's got to do something. I think the people at Prattsville are some of the strongest people I've ever met. I really am. They were really knocked back, really knocked back. And despite all the problems that they have and all the impediments that have been put in their way, they are coming back, and they're gonna triumph over all their problems. There's no two ways about it. I'm really proud of the people there because they're really trying so hard.
Carolyn, is there anything else that you want people to know about Prattsville?
Well, just want them to know that I believe it's an incredibly important early American town, one of this nation's and New York State's first planned communities. If people knew the history of the town the way that I know it, they would be astounded that we can't have this kind of history here. We sort of equate history with, you know, Massachusetts, Plymouth, and Williamsburg, but we have an equally incredible history in Greene County and in Prattsville. It's just very impressive. And the other thing is that I would like to make a plug for on August 26th, the Sunday at Mudfest, the museum will be holding a live art auction and silent auction from 3 to 5 in the Carriage House to help raise funds for some of the things that you so kindly let me talk about today.
And presumably the other thing you want to tell people is just to show up on that date.
Oh, we're going to have a lot of fun, absolutely, you know, so be prepared to
get muddy.
To all things mud.
All things mud. Should people wear anything special for this?
I think they should wear very casual clothing because on the Sunday at Devasigo Park, which is at the west end of town, and it's a newly coined or minted park. It's been created, I think, to allow some development to go up that way. And there'll be mud games, a mud tug of war, mud slides. So I think you should dress ready to get down and get dirty.
Okay. Well, that's great. Okay, Carolyn, I just want to thank you very much for being on Between the Lines.
And I want to thank you, and I want to thank your station, because during the flood and after the flood, you have been a great friend to Prattsville and to me as well. So thank you.
If you've just joined us, this is Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. Coming up, Andrew Amelinks, with an episode from his Difficult History series he did for WGXC last year. This one is on fear and danger.
Your heart races. Your breathing speeds up. Your muscles tighten. Your body becomes suddenly cold. A fight or flight response. Fear. This month, we look at fear and the stimulus that produces it, danger. Here's how it works. The hypothalamus, located at the base of the brain and about the size of an almond, is a key player in our autonomic response to danger. The hypothalamus activates two systems, the sympathetic nervous system, which uses neural pathways, and the pituitary adrenocortical system, which uses the bloodstream to prepare us to either stand and fight or head for the hills in the face of a perceived threat. The hypothalamus, through the sympathetic nervous system, tells the adrenal medulla to release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the bloodstream, which increases the heart rate and blood pressure. At the same time, the hypothalamus activates the pituitary gland, releasing adrenocorticotropic hormone, which rushes through the bloodstream, and upon reaching the adrenal cortex, activates more than 24 hormones that also prepare us to deal with a dangerous situation. And all in the space of a few seconds. So what if we don't realize we're actually about to face a potentially dangerous situation? I spoke with Lindsay Suchow recently about how she spent her 23rd birthday. She jumped out of a plane. Before she was up in the air, hundreds of feet above the Hudson Valley, she said she really hadn't been nervous about skydiving. But once at the precipice, her fight-or-flight response kicked in full throttle.
Well, before I did it, honestly, like, I was actually really cocky. And I was scared, but more, like, excited. Like, I was like, oh, I can handle this, you know, it'll be just like a, you know, a really scary roller coaster or something like that. The fear didn't really settle in until I was up there in the air. That's when it really hit me that I'm not getting off of this airplane unless I jump out. Like, I'm jumping out of this plane, you know, and that's really when I got very, very scared. But before that, I was kind of cocky, you know. I was kind of like, oh, this is going to be great. You know, I listened to everything the guy told me to do, and I was totally fine. And then, you know, I instantly forgot everything.
When she was younger, Lindsay had a fear of heights. But over time, got over it. Eventually, going on roller coasters and flying in airplanes.
And just, like, gradually I started liking that kind of stuff. So I figured, you know, skydiving was the next step.
And so she did. A friend of hers, who had been jumping for several months, invited her to come. This is in 2008. It's her birthday. And so she's up. And this is when the fear starts to set in.
My mind was kind of blank. Like, I was kind of paralyzed by the fear. I was up there, you know, we took off, and once we were really up there and we were looking down, you know, the tandem guy, the guy who was tandem to me, the instructor, he started pointing things out, like, oh, look, you can see the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, and look over there, that's the Shawangunk Ridge, and, you know, and that's when it really started, like, you know, I started thinking about jumping out of the plane, you know, that's, I was looking down and thinking how I was going to be outside, I don't know, it's just, and he started saying, you know, oh, there's this town over there, Gino New Paltz, and I was like, no. And meanwhile, you know, I had lived in New Paltz for like 2 years before that. I went to SUNY New Paltz. I knew all about it, but like my mind was just, I didn't know anything.
The idea that, you know, this could, that you could die doing it, did that ever come into your mind?
Well, you know, that actually, the odds, you know, were so low. And, it, you know, he talked to me beforehand, and I asked him how many times he had jumped, and, you know, he told me he was, you know, had jumped over 1,000 times, and wow. So I felt pretty safe in terms yeah. of the death factor. I mean, but at the same time, like, that was definitely one of the thoughts that went through my mind once I was up there, you know what I mean? I was, yeah. like, what if something goes wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. But it all happened so fast that, you know, everything was good. You know, I always had this image of, like, jumping out of the plane, you know, kind of like going to the edge and leaping out. Meanwhile, it really wasn't like that. I was told to kind of like lean back. There was this bar above you that like you reached up and you grabbed the bar and you kind of would like swing on the bar. And he told me to lean back on the bar and then lean forward and then lean back again. And then the next time I leaned forward to just let go. So it was more like you're falling out of the plane. You're really falling. You're free falling. You know what I mean? And that part, that is kind of when the thought of death briefly, you know, being squashed on the ground, that was definitely like a very quick image, but still, you know, not really. I felt pretty safe. the free falling was great. I had such a blast. Like, because you feel like you're flying, you know, because you're just, it's just you, you know, falling through the air and the wind, and you're going so incredibly fast. And that part was unbelievable. Like, on the video, you can see I'm having such a great time during that part. Like, I'm, you know, yelling, I'm going, yeah, you know, I can't believe it. But the parachute part, when we, after we pulled the parachute and we were kind of just floating down, I started feeling really sick and very cold, and I was very uncomfortable and pretty scared because we were still really high up. And I knew that he knew what he was doing, but it was still very unnerving being that high up and, you know, kind of gliding down and having to worry about, you know, landing right and everything. When we landed, I stood up and my knees were wobbly. And they're like, oh, look, she's got the wobbly knees. So I guess that's something that happens to a lot of people. And I just felt, to be honest, I felt, you know, for lack of a better word, like intoxicated. Like I, you know, I was kind of dizzy and really, you know, giddy and kind of shaky. And my friend, you know, who that was her first time jumping alone that day, she sees me and she's like, that's adrenaline. That's, you know, welcome to having an adrenaline high. That's why we do this every day, because of that feeling. And so that was a pretty cool feeling. It was like definitely like a drug, sort of. And I can definitely see how people can get affected to that thrill of just, like, surviving something like that, you know what I mean? But, and then they asked me if I would do it again, and I said, ask me again tomorrow. I don't know if I would do it again, because it really was so scary, and now knowing what to expect, I feel like it would be even scarier.
Danger can be a drug, and danger can be a song that haunts our sleep. Joe Moore was drawn to the darkness, danger, and menace that runs through that most American of musical traditions, the blues. This undercurrent of danger snakes through traditional American music, from Lead Belly's version of In the Pines to John Lee Hooker's Crawling Kingsnake, and was eventually co-opted by rock and roll, especially by British bands like The Animals, The Rolling Stones, and Led Zeppelin. In the face of today's overproduced pop and R&B, Moore makes music both haunting and haunted by unspoken menace and a sense of danger that looks back to an earlier tradition but remains as personal as a prayer.
And in the asylum, finding the time to draw on the patio, sketches a miracle home. With the palm of your hand on the pulse of the scene, you've been stalking the vagrants, shaking them down for change. Originally from, I was born in Georgia, but I grew up in Virginia, and I was there for, you know, the first 20 years of my life or so. I was in California and Los Angeles for a while, back to New York City, and most recently Hudson, New York. Been writing music in one form or another for probably 20 years at this point. I feel like the most recent incarnation, you know, with the singer-songwriter stuff has been about a 10-year thing.
So were you in bands before that?
I was in bands before, you know, collaborating and, you know, playing guitar or whatever, collaborating with other band members, and those projects sort of, you know, the songs died with the projects, you know, so I don't know. I think I was drawn to songwriting pretty early when, you know, I started playing guitar, and it just became this It was just a place I felt that I could express myself more freely, because the whole guitar playing pigeonhole, you know, had to do with guitar solos and chops and all this stuff that I wasn't really that interested in. It just wasn't drawn to naturally. So the overall composition, you know, lyrically and everything else, just I was just drawn to that.
So what's your writing process like?
Writing process is, it's different every time. I mean, it can be excruciating, and sometimes it can be effortless. But it's usually, there's that initial inspiration for the tune, where most of the time, 50 to 75% of the tune is written during that initial period, which can be 15 minutes, or an hour or something, sitting around messing with something, and then it's the finishing the song part. That's committing to the final draft of it, which is that's what can take a long time sometimes. That's what can become a bit of a labor, but they've come easy at times. It's usually chords and melody that come first, and quite often there is a lyric that comes with that right there at the beginning. And then it's time to fill in the blanks. It's time to figure out kind of what the tune is supposed to be about. And rather than abandon whatever that initial lyric was, I usually try to work with it, because I just feel like it's supposed to be there, that it was part of the initial inspiration. And so it's like, if it's just one line or a couple lines, it might be extremely vague, and then I have to figure out what it means. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely common themes, and then there are themes that I stay away from pretty deliberately. A lot of songs have been written about the relationships between men and women, celebratory songs and everything like that, and I just don't feel like I need to add to that catalog, so I stay away from love songs, really. Although, having said that, it's like there's, that's the relationship someone has, with someone else is such a powerful thing that it ends up feeding in there somehow. But, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I it's kind of weird. I mean, I guess a lot of my stuff is probably a little on the melancholy side, or a lot on the melancholy side, and tends to be kind of dark. But I'm drawn to that lyrically. I feel that there is more inspiration in that well for me than there is, on the sunnier side of the street. So that seems to be the common thread. And it goes beyond that. I mean, there's I have rules for myself within working with that to not be so literal with things, mm-hmm. to allow things to exist in sort of shades of gray.
So, sort of the idea of retaining some sort of mystery, or...
mystery definitely, and space. Space is an important one. I really try not to overwrite a song. There's plenty of songwriters who, can be described as very clever, very witty, very smart songwriting, whatever like that. I tend to feel that it's, I don't know, I think I just sort of think of music as being a different thing. It's not a purely intellectual process to, you know, making it or you know, listening to it. I feel like it's this other thing. It's this more visceral thing in a way, and allowing lyrics to breathe and not pack it full of, you know, everything that, you know, my entire vocabulary, you know, not pack it full of so many images that it feels cluttered, you know. And the song arrangements the same way. They need to breathe. Musical influence.
Yes.
Yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot of the ones that are probably obvious, but I mean, I was actually just talking to someone about this yesterday. I spent a lot of my early years, my high school years, when I was learning how to play guitar and everything, partly because I felt like I should. I was listening to a lot of 40s and 50s blues music, like real deal stuff, like really obscure stuff. I just lucked across some stuff, you know, Guitar Slim and I don't know, just all these cats that like that I found accidentally, and it was a good thing to be able to discern between, you know, something like B.B. King Glide of the Regal, something that was a little bit more slick like that, and then, you know, something like John Lee Hooker, and be able to, you know, start to understand what that starkness of the latter can really do for mood and emotion and everything like that. So I there's definitely that stuff. You know, as far as rock and roll, you know, there's you know, definitely some of the British stuff, but it's like I definitely lean way more in the Rolling Stones, Animals, Them, you know, Van Morrison's early efforts. I'm way more in that camp than the Beatles camp. I just don't really relate to that stuff as much. So, you know, that was a line that was drawn in the sand early on. It's like, you know, like the Beatles and Stones thing, you know. It's like, and somewhere along the way, I realized that I had been listening to a lot of stuff that was heavily influenced by country music for a lot of years, and hadn't really gotten a proper education in country music. And somewhere along the way, you know, I started listening to some of that and some of the real good stuff, you know, from the 60s and 70s, and like, you know, Merle Haggard and that whole streak that he had in the 60s. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Redheaded Stranger, Willie Nelson, and stuff like that was just huge, you know.
There seems to be a sense of, in that music, a sense of either danger or maybe, you know, menace, or, and not just, you know, lyrically, but sort of in the heart of the music. Is, you know, is that something that you're drawn to?
Yeah, I'm definitely, I'm absolutely drawn to that. And that's like, I mean, you know, I listen to a fair amount of pretty heavy music too, and I think that that's what it is. I would, on one hand, I would describe it as menace and danger, and then, you know, on the other hand, I just describe it as drama. You know, I love the sense of drama in, you know, Metallica or Iron Maiden. You know, I mean, it's there, and it's very real, and maybe over the top. But it's like, I mean, come on, it's like, you know, we're talking about music, we're talking about entertainment, and like, you know, giving some motion to these feelings that we've got. You know, it's like, if it makes you want to drive the car faster, it's probably doing its job, you know. It's all autobiographical to a degree. To say it wasn't, you know, it's just like, I'm not enough of a storyteller to just, you know, just spin a yarn from a completely objective place, but it's autobiographical just in the sense that it's like it's at least, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees removed. It's like looking at something, you know, in a mirror around a corner. It's not, you know, necessarily, you know, the central person in a story, you know, whether it's someone I knew or a manifestation of myself in the way I remember some experience, I'm not really sure, but I need to be able to relate. I guess, it's like these details that make up, you know, a song or a story are merely details. You know, it's like we've got a limited array of human emotions that we're able to, you know, experience, you know, and it's the details that really make it a varied sort of thing, you know. So it's just like, you know, you're starting with this one thing, and it's like, it's almost like a triangle. It's almost like just something that cascades down, and by the time you get to the bottom, you know, it's very full and rich with all the details of one's experience. But at the peak of it, it's this very familiar thing that everybody can relate to. And I try to look at it like that. I try to achieve that. And so at the center of everything, yeah, there's an emotion that I've experienced.
Evangeline, all dressed in white, heard your name before. Footnote on a page somewhere in a book on local lore. Evangeline, all dressed in white, heard you called a whore. Seen them families torn apart, your country gone to war. But it's all for nothing, like an ode to nothing at all. I ever loved is gone and I've been down. Heartache for so long, I've been dragged out, left laying on the ground. I don't feel so nothing's real. Evangeline, the cold side of this mountain here in this darkest time of night, need to catch a glimpse before they scurry out of sight. But in wintertime you hear their cries just rising on the wind. Judgment has been handed down and now I'm one of them. But it's all for nothing, like an ode to nothing at all. I ever loved is gone and I've been down. Heartache for so long and been dragged out, left laying on the ground. I don't feel so nothing's real. Evangeline, I'ma be the shadow you see crawling across the floor. A winter wind just howling by your door. And I can't stand seeing you alone. No.
has been Between the Lines. Thank you so much for listening. And I'd like to thank all my guests today, Professor Robert Titus, Carolyn Bennett, Larry Gambon, and also Andrew Amalix for letting us use his Difficult Histories excerpt. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. My next show will be the third Thursday in September. And meanwhile, once again, WGXC is devoting its coverage from August 28th to September 3rd to after the flood.